Welcome to another edition of The Bandwagon. We've gone to our nice every other week schedule now. I'm Brian Moline. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Lisa Braltz, and thank you for joining us. Yes.
Yes, and good Thanksgiving, Lisa.
Oh, yeah. We had fun. Always good to get together with some of the family. How about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I saw the fam up in Iowa. So
you traveled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Drove about 5 hours, give or take, and had plenty of food as always.
Oh man,
plenty of sleep, which
also
was good.
Very
good. And so we're back and ready for another edition of The Bandwagon here, and kind of a college sports spectacular here on this edition of The Bandwagon.
And I would say even mostly like football.
Yeah.
It seems like we're going to be kind of football centric because also, like, of course, it was Thanksgiving, and so there's always football news. And didn't basically the college season just end this past weekend for a lot of people?
Yeah, for most teams it did. It came to an end. There are a few games next week, mostly college championship games,
right,
and a few other scattered ones thrown in. But for all intents and purposes, the football season came to an end. So yeah, just some interesting issues surrounding college sports that we're going to be talking about today. And one that's been on our radar here for a while, Lisa, talking about how technology is kind of changing the way that teams train, the way that teams practice. And Ohio State was the example that was brought out in this article from the Associated Press a while ago. And it's just amazing how things have advanced from the days when I was playing high school football two-a-days and all that kind of stuff. And it's just the advances that they're making with technology now are just pretty amazing.
Well, I love this paragraph in this article that you referenced, and we'll make sure it's in the show notes so listeners can read it. Tyvis Powell and Joshua Perry wrap a band around their torsos and place an electrode on their hands and forehead and link it up to an iPod. After about 5 minutes, the players take the gear off and head to the locker room. The device is one of many ways Coach Urban Meyer's staff tracks how players are holding up to the wear and tear of football. The data gathered will help tell coaches whether to go hard or ease up when the players hit the practice field. And that, to me, I'm like, we live in the future.
Yes.
It's like the Jetsons playing football now. And, you know, I've always been really interested in, like, futurology and predictions ever since I was a little kid. And I remember, I was probably in eighth grade or something, and there was some book of predictions that came out, and they predicted that sometime in my lifetime, humans would no longer be playing sports. We'd be watching robots or cyborgs or human robot hybrids or whatever. And while, of course, we are not there yet by any means, when I read stuff like this, it sort of reminds me of those kinds of things where we have everything so calibrated now that we're even getting into the arena of sports where it's not just like go hard and reap the benefits. It's more like don't go as hard and you'll be more awesome on Saturday. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And because I think back to reading about, you know, days of the 1950s, there was that book a while back, and of course I can't remember, but it was all about Bear Bryant's tenure at Texas A&M and talking about how he practiced those guys so hard in August to get them ready for the season. He wouldn't even let them drink water during practice.
Oh,
that was a sign of weakness, to drink water during a practice. Now, thankfully, things had evolved a bit by the time I played high school football in the early 90s, where, hey, the coaches would actually allow us to drink water.
Right.
You know, that was great. But just seeing what they're doing here, basically trying to make sure that the players are at their peak physical condition on game day, that involves a lot of times, as you mentioned, kind of pulling back on their practice load during the week.
Right. Well, it says here, too, just speaking to what you just said, the days of getting a team ready, Junction Boy style, pushing players well beyond their physical limits for the sake of making them tougher is mostly gone. Here's to me the money quote. You're training a secretariat, Notre Dame Director of Strength and Conditioning Paul Longo said, like a racehorse. They're comparing these athletes to racehorses, and which I think is pretty interesting. And also, the idea that strength and conditioning programs making guys and girls go hard. I used to do 2 or 3 a day volleyball practices. We were allowed to drink water, but I think that was like a team unity thing too. Like we're all toughing it out together, and you know, if you're not puking together, then you're not going to be able to play together, that kind of thing. And so I wonder how it affects team. Do they team build in other ways where you're not like collapsing from exhaustion or playing through an injury, which is another thing that, you know, I'm sure is not cool anymore. Although we've talked a little bit about that, especially when players get their bells rung mm-hmm. and they get back up, whether it's football or soccer or whatever. You know, when is it okay to play through an injury or go really hard, and when isn't it? Is that a mixed message that players get?
Yeah, it's. I think it's interesting knowing the difference between being, you know, hurt where you've got some pain that might not be a permanent thing, and when you're actually injured where you could do more damage and push through it. One thing I saw here too that I thought was interesting, and just something that we were kind of discussing. Before every practice, every Ohio State player takes a urine test mm-hmm. to determine their level of hydration. Players that are not properly hydrated don't practice until they are.
Yeah, that's taking it, I think, to the nth degree. That's not a player saying, yeah, I've had enough to drink, let's go. That's like trusting a computer or mm-hmm. software to tell them that. But, you know, I've seen it even here at the U of I in sports that aren't football, because this article does mention that it's not just Ohio State that does mm-hmm. this. A lot of college programs do this. But and even when my daughter went to a soccer camp here at the University of Illinois, it was a Janet Rayfield camp, Coach mm-hmm. Janet Rayfield, they wore heart monitors. You know, so and like, you know, to sort of measure like what their heart rate was and what their fitness level was. So I think you're going to see this in a lot of different sports in order to it's like getting the best return on your investment, I think, in a lot of ways, it seems like, for some of these teams. You know, like if we're giving scholarships to these young people, then we want to make sure that they are performing at their peak.
Yeah. And there's a quote from Urban Meyer in here that I think hits to that as well. He says, there's a bit of selfishness in all of this. Player safety is always number one, but player safety leads to better football teams. We had the same starting lineup in October as we did in August last year. So from his perspective, if you practice smarter, fewer injuries, less missed time, better football team on the field.
And so does this so I assume pro teams have already been using these technologies on their own teams for quite some time, or have been growing into the use of that as technologies have developed. So now it seems like it's just trickling down to the college game, so that those players who do move to the next level are not unaccustomed to being treated that mm-hmm. that way, as more secretariats than workhorses, I suppose.
Yeah, Clydesdales.
Clydesdales. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, that was and that sort of can lead into talking about athletes and safety, their mm-hmm. physical safety we're talking about here. Of course, since our last episode, Frank Gifford's family came out and said that they had donated his brain to science, and that it wasn't just evidence of CTE, he had had it.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't something I ever heard about with him, and he was 82, 3,
yeah,
4,
or, yeah,
something like that.
There.
So
yeah.
I just thought, well, you know, maybe it was Frank's time to go.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently his family had been worried enough or thought, you know, that they could make that decision to donate his brain to science and investigate if it would help other families or help further the cause of figuring out what the story is with brain injuries and football. And, of course, it came back, if you had heard the news, it came back that he had had CTE. I'm not going to try and pronounce everything there,
right,
all those words. But so I think it's interesting when we're talking about treating athletes like racehorses and, you know, caring so much about their hydration. When you're talking about football, this is still a sport where you can have a career-ending injury in a split second. And you could argue that that could happen in any sport. But I think in football, where hitting is so much of the game, the idea is to hit the other person as hard as you can so that mm-hmm. they can't keep doing what they're doing, not score on you. I think it's interesting to use these technologies, but at the same time, you're putting your secretariat out in an environment where they could break their leg or worse.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is probably a good way to seg into our kind of our next topic here. And you mentioned Frank Gifford dealing with head injuries from his playing career. There are actually now two University of Minnesota doctors that are recommending that football be eliminated from high schools, from schools all the way up through high school. And here's just a little bit of what they say. 5 to 20% of students experience at least one concussion in a season of play. 9 to 12-year-old players experience an average of 240 head impacts per season. High school players average 650 head impacts per season. There's a lot of blows to the head going on there. And I mean, I remember that from my days playing football. Who knows what kind of an impact that had? I hope not much, but really without having it...
So far, so good.
Yeah, without having it studied in depth, I really have no way of knowing that. But just seeing those numbers laid out there does, you know, make it a little more more real, I guess.
Well, and also this article mentions, and I think this has been discussed in the news, just even talking about brain development in young people, their brains are still developing. Mm-hmm. These young, especially when you're 12 or whatever, and you're starting to play football, tackle football, and taking these blows to the head, these impact, having plays where your head and neck are being impacted, brains are still developing. There's, you know, and your brain is not just like stuck to your skull. It's kind of swimming around in there. And so every time, not just that you're getting hit by another person or that you're hitting another person, like, you know, tackling them in their torso or whatever, but your head's hitting the ground. When you fall, your head jars. It hits the ground or it snaps back and forth. It's like mini whiplashes all the time. And that's not necessarily that great for your brain either. I thought this piece was interesting. And also that the doctors, they make this recommendation, but they know it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. They're not going to get rid of, it's not like Minnesota is going to be like, oh God, you know, no more high school football.
But I do think what all this is doing is I do think it is having an impact on how parents feel about the game.
Absolutely.
And one of the things I did over the weekend when I was up visiting family is I got together with my college roommate. He's a band director at a school in Iowa, fairly large high school. It's actually probably about the size of one of the Champaign-Urbana high schools up there. And he was telling me that that right now in his high school, which actually has a good football tradition, they've won state titles. They've got a good program there. The football program is now smaller in numbers than the cross country program, which happens at the exact same time.
And so, what's been the trajectory of that? Like over the last how many years? When did it really start to?
He's been there about 10 years, and I think it's really been in the last 5 that he's seen those numbers really start to change. You've got more and more kids doing a sport like cross country, no impact whatsoever except on your, you know, your legs,
right,
where you're just running, and very much more an individual sport. Obviously, you do have a team in cross country, but it's mostly just about you running the best time you can run, as opposed to football with the other possibilities of injury and everything else. I think he told me that it was just barely over 50 kids out for varsity football this year, and there were more than 60 kids out for cross country at this school.
So what do you think about, so say they did say, okay, no more high school football. What if it was more for club than country, so to speak? You know, they have that expression in soccer, you play for you have your club team, but you play for your country. You know, I think school spirit is a big part of high school football, and that sort of, do you think if they just got rid of high school football and made it a club sport, would more kids play then because it would be elective rather than this thing that they felt like they would have to do for school spirit? Or
yeah, I don't know.
I don't even think do high school American football club teams even exist with the high school programs being so big?
No, at this point they don't, and it might be interesting to see if that develops, because now you do have, in more and more sports, the club sports,
right?
And that everywhere from AAU basketball.
Well, and you play in your off season. You play for your club in your off season, like when you're not playing for your high school team. So,
yeah.
I don't know. They also recommend maybe switching over. Well, they don't recommend it here, but I've also heard recommendations like it should all be flag football.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, well, I mean, would that work? And then they're like, they should take off their helmets and just make them play. You know, there'd be fewer head injuries if you were playing without helmets. I'm like, geesh, like, come on, look at rugby. I mean, there are people getting hurt playing that too. I think, though, this particular article, which again, we will link to this article in the show notes as well, the adage, don't ever read the comments, never, ever read the comments. There aren't many comments, but I found that the people who did decide to comment generally were like, hey, I played back in the 60s and millions of, I'm fine. So why would you recommend doing this, you know, just to keep kids safer. Most kids are fine. Maybe some people don't make it, whatever. And then, you know, and then people are being accused of wanting to coddle the youth of today. And, you know, let's get rid of cars for teenagers because blah, blah, mm-hmm. you know. So I think here, you know, when you've got young brains and young knees and ankles. I mean, I think, you know, my daughter just had a surgery on her ankle and she plays soccer and it was just like an accident. It wasn't even like a hit or a blow. She just stepped into a hole on the turf and went down the wrong way. I mean, yes, there are risks in sports. Absolutely. But is a kid's brain something you really want to play with?
Yeah. And I think, you know, talking about taking away cars, well, they haven't taken away cars, but they've sure made them a lot safer than they were.
Absolutely.
30, 40, 50 years ago.
That's
that was
true.
One of the big things that Ralph Nader pushed for, kind of how he got on the map back in the 1960s, was making cars safer, and they're infinitely safer.
Well, and everyone wears a seatbelt now too. Mm-hmm. So, but again, I've also heard that because of helmet technology and padding technology, people think they can hit each other harder. Is there more reckless driving happening because cars are safer and we just feel like, well, if I hit something, the airbag's going to go off? I mean, there were no airbags in cars when I was in high school. No one wore their seatbelt when mm-hmm. I was in high school. And I turned out fine, but you better believe my kid, if I don't see them wearing a seatbelt now when they're driving our cars, grounded. You're grounded. You don't get to drive my cars anymore. And or wearing helmets when they ride bikes. I mean, how is this weakness? I don't see it as weakness.
No, I don't either. I think it's just being smart.
Right.
I think it's being smart about it and minimizing the risk. There's always going to be risk in just about anything you do, but I think it's about figuring out the best way to minimize that risk and still continue. And do I think football's going away anytime soon? No, but I do think that these discussions will probably prompt some much-needed discussions on how to make football as safe as it can be.
Right. And I think that's what Frank Gifford's family was kind of getting at, too. They still support football and they love football, but they wanted to make this information available and to help make the game, as you say, safer. So one thing that also interests me is if numbers continue to decline for football in high school, what does that mean for college?
Yeah.
What does that mean for college teams? What does that mean for the Ohio States where, you know, you have your high school kids who did make it through seemingly unscathed and coming into your Ohio States, your Illinois, your whoever's, Notre Dame's. I mean, and if the numbers have changed that quickly at your friend's school in mm-hmm. just a few years, really, what does that mean for colleges coming down the line?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and it'll be one that I'm sure that they monitor, because I've heard other numbers showing that the participation in youth football has declined.
Mm-hmm.
I think the number I heard was 10% mm-hmm. that it's declined over the last decade or so. So we'll see. I think there are always going to be those who want to play it regardless, but at some level you would think it would have some kind of an impact. Something else that could have an impact on college football and has had to a degree already is kind of the increased, I don't know if power is the right word, but the increased voice of college
yes,
athletes.
Maybe empowerment mm-hmm. as opposed to power.
We saw recently after last week's loss to Michigan, Ohio State running back Ezekiel Elliott questioning the coaching staff after the game. You know, I think it's always been understood that, no, you don't call out your coaching staff after the game. If you're an athlete, you
never
like, question the coach.
We were like, at our house, like, oh, man, did he really say that? Yeah.
Yeah, and now it's becoming more common. It's still unusual, but it's becoming more common for athletes to voice their discontent. A lot of times it's after they've already left school or mm-hmm. after they left the program, so there's no chance of any repercussions. That's what happened with Simon Svijanovic here at Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
After he had left the team, then he voiced his displeasure with what happened, with how he was treated here at the university, and of course that had an impact with Coach Beckman being fired. But now you've got Ezekiel Elliott, who's still on the team,
mm-hmm.
but I think he feels as one of the star players that he might be able to voice his discontent without too much fear of reprisal from the coaching staff.
Did he get in trouble?
Not that I'm aware of. I never saw anything about, I mean, he wasn't suspended or anything. He played against Michigan and had a really good game,
right.
Rushed for over 200 yards in that game.
Right.
There was nothing I saw, unless maybe there was some extra work he had to do at practice or something, but I never heard anything about any punishment for Zeke, as he's known.
Well, I think it it seems to me like it just sort of points toward when you have properties, players who are really, really good and who aren't just racehorses, but who are smart racehorses and who understand their position on the team and what their role is and what it is that they're supposed to do, and they're really good at what they do. It seems like it's more of a collaborative effort to coach that person, more lateral, you know, as opposed to top-down hierarchical thing where the coach is right no matter what. I don't care. I don't care if you're right. I'm still the coach and what I say goes. Would another team have handled it as well? You know, would a coach apart who isn't Urban Meyer have handled being called out in the press like that? I don't know. But it seems to me that not just this player, I'm sure it happens a fair amount with other players too, not just in college football either, but in other sports where the athlete has more of a role in their development at the college level. And in their playmaking, play calling, things like that. This guy wasn't a quarterback. Typically, the quarterback seems to me in college football to be given more of that sort of leadership on the field role. Maybe in this case, this player also has that role and feels like, you know, he's able to. I don't know. It's interesting to me that he kind of went out in the press. I'm sure this kind of thing happens all the time, but players don't necessarily go public with it.
Yeah, I would, you know, a lot of times, you know.
And what was his desired result by doing that? Getting the ball more times
in the
next game?
Yeah.
And which he did, and they won.
Yeah.
And he had a great game, right?
Yeah, so exactly. So I think that was the biggest thing that he was questioning, was that, hey, I've been the most productive player on offense for this team all year. I need to get the ball more. And, well, at least based on the results from those two games, going from a loss against Michigan State where they only scored 14 points, the win against Michigan, I think they scored 42 in that game, and he rushed for over 200 yards. So at least based on those results, hey, guy might be right.
Well, and if that, I mean, and that, is that kind of empowerment bad? I don't think it is bad for a young person to learn that it's okay to ask for what you want, especially if you know that you can deliver the goods. I really don't feel like it's bad to be empowered. And I do think, you know, some of the empowerment that we've talked about, not just about calling coaches on what happened in a game, their decisions that they made in the game, but also around unionization, also around influencing other activities on campus. Some of this is power for the first time felt by some of these young people, where it's not necessarily tied specifically to them playing the game. They are able to experience power not just in athletic dominance, but also in their future, in how a game is played, in what happens on a campus, in how players are or are not compensated for the work that they do. That's a different kind of power that I think is important for young people to feel like they have some agency here. This is not typically the way that we see or associate power with sports, I think.
Yeah, it's a little different. You know, having college athletes feel like they have a voice, whether it's at Missouri, those players going on strike down there, basically saying we're not going to play until some changes are made in the administration, and they were able to create that change down at Missouri. And we'll see what happens there long term, but at least in the short term, those players were able to exercise that power to make a change they felt was necessary on that college campus.
And the players at Northwestern who were attempting to unionize, I think that their football team was working hard, and they weren't allowed to. But it really did get me thinking about college football, especially. It's such a huge moneymaker. And when you, I know I should not read the comments, but I would read the comments sometimes, and these people commenting would say, hey, they get a free ride to school. You know, they're totally being taken care of for 4 years. I'm like, how much is that worth? At a school like Northwestern, we'll call it maybe $500,000 if you, you know, include tuition, food, housing, travel, all of those things. But again, those are the travel and everything especially is included. It's part of being a team. You have to fly them around or bus them around or whatever it is that you do. And so it's great if they finish school. Not all of them do. If they finish school, they have a degree, and hopefully they're able to go out and do something with it. When I say $500,000, that is like the way upper end of like when you're looking at Stanford's and Northwestern's and schools that like really cost a lot of money. But when I think about how much money those teams are making off of those players, way more than that, way more than the cost of the investment.
Oh, the TV contracts alone.
It's huge.
Billions of dollars.
Yeah.
Every year.
Billions with a B. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is not, you know, these players' likenesses, their numbers, that, you know, they're being used, mm-hmm. basically. It used to be 20 years ago, they were just playing football and they were still getting the same ride. Mm-hmm. So now they're getting that ride, but way more money is being made off of what they do. And you know, are they supposed to be happy with just being like more famous? Famous on Twitter? I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how you can justify that as compensation. I don't think it is.
Yeah, it's a whole new ball game, so to speak, than it was 20, 30 years ago. But, well, Lisa, I think that will probably wrap it up here for this edition.
I think we have raised more questions than we've answered, Brian.
But that's the point, starting the conversation.
Exactly. So, yeah, we'll be bringing you more and more conversations in the coming months, I'm sure, not just about college sports, but about all the sports. We didn't even talk about, like, I have to have this one last thing in here. What is the strategy here at the University of Illinois with football, as long as we're talking about football? What's the strategy behind extending your coach's contract, your interim coach's contract, by 2 years before the end of the season for everybody else, when all these coaches are going to, when the whole domino effect starts to happen with this coach is leaving and going here and this coach is leaving and going here? What's the strategy there?
The strategy, as near as I can tell, is that it will be no permanent athletic director in place in time to take advantage of the coaching carousel for this year. So this is a Band-Aid to have something in place, and then once they get a new athletic director hired, he'll be able to deal with it.
Or she.
Or she, correct.
Okay. Well, we can maybe discuss that another time, but thank you for answering my question, because the commenters on Reddit, it's like their minds were blown by this whole episode. So we could talk about Reddit some other time. It's a pretty interesting world there for sports. Anyway, that's going to do it for us today. Thank you so much for joining us on The Bandwagon, where there's plenty of room for everyone. Bandwagon is produced by Lisa Braltz and Brian Moline. That's us. Brian also works the board and edits this thing. Scott Cameron is our director of news and public affairs. And this podcast was actually his idea. So thanks to him for his support. Our theme song is an old B-side by this band you might have heard of called R.E.M.
Who?
R.E.M. Athens, GA, my friend. You can find past episodes of Bandwagon at will.illinois.edu, as well as links to the articles that we talk about and show notes. We would love your feedback via email, or if you prefer to start a conversation online, you can ping us at Twitter at
B-Moline, W-I-L-L,
and or Lisa Braltz. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.